listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, your alternative to mainstream media. Broadcasting from Simon Fraser University at Burnaby Mountain, British Columbia.
From the Netherlands, this is the Green Planet Monitor, voices and stories from a warm, wet planet. Today, in West Africa, French colonialism officially ended in the 1960s. Neo-colonialism lives on.
The French told them, we are going to give you independence, but without sovereignty over any state domain. For example, public education, foreign trade, currency management, and so on. So that's why this system is colonial.
America is the world's preeminent imperial power these days, some say, and NATO, one of its sturdiest colonial tools.
NATO was founded to undermine the socialist and communist parties in Western Europe. The other part was about bringing the former colonial world under the U.S. geopolitical umbrella. And so Canada gave all kinds of weaponry to the French while they were trying to maintain control over Vietnam. Canada was providing bullets to the French to suppress the independence movement in Algeria. Same for the British fighting the so-called Mau Mau, the Kikuyu in Kenya, and the Belgians while they were trying to maintain control over Congo.
In Cambodia, European colonists are long gone. Military chiefs and their rich clients rule the roost, much to the detriment of diverse ecosystems.
Some military and some the government officials declared a mangrove for a shrimp farm. And after that, you know, they clear more mangrove forest for their own property.
This is the Green Planet Monitor. Before diving in, a request. Help us deliver this weekly package of Earth news. Subscribe and or donate at greenplanetmonitor.net. Senegal, on the western edge of Africa, has long been considered an anchor of stability. Today, tension fills the air. Senegalese opposition leader Ousmane Sonko, a would-be presidential candidate, is on life support following a three-week hunger strike protesting his house arrest. Sonko supporters say he's being targeted because he wants to change Senegal's relationship with France, that many see as neo-colonial. It's a common theme across West Africa today, where the economic legacy of colonialism is a daily reality. Over a century ago, France banned the use of the cowrie shell as an exchange currency, imposing its own, the CFA. The meaning of the term has changed over the years. French colonies of Africa, French community of Africa, African financial community. Today, the CFA is backed by the French treasury, and France enjoys a huge trade advantage. Inflation and the dependency of its former colonies on imported commodities fuel staggering poverty, also violent extremism. Most of the military coups that have taken place in recent years across the Sahel region have been in former French colonies. Alexa Dvorsin has lived and worked in Senegal. During her most recent trip in 2022, Senegal won the Africa Cup of Nations football tournament for the first time, defeating Egypt on penalties. Euphoria and hope for the future filled the air. It didn't last long. Alexa Dvorsin brings us this report from that trip from the Senegalese capital Dakar on the Atlantic Ocean, Africa's western tip.
This is a recorded sales pitch in Wolof, Senegal's main language, for the deep-fried, orange-flavored sweets in Amadou Diarra's food cart. They go for the equivalent of 15 cents each. That's his nephew with the tagline, "Mama, here they come." Diarra barely scrapes out a living with the fresh batter he mixes every morning. He uses a popular app to send daily earnings to his family about 150 miles away.
Chaque jour, je fais ça, du matin au soir. Quand j'ai 5000 francs, je vais envoyer ça.
5000, 5,000 in local currency, is around $8. Diarra wheels his cart about 15 miles a day through these sand-filled streets from dawn till dusk. No small feat for a 45-year-old. But he's proud to do this, he says. It gives him courage.
Moi, je suis fier de ça parce que ça me rend courageux.
And courage is what all these street vendors need to compete for customers at Koloban, a frenetic transit hub with stacks of jeans, shirts, shoes, hats, belts, and backpacks for sale. But the money everyone's after is hardly worth anything, because the CFA, the currency introduced in 1945, is still controlled by France. Proponents say its fixed conversion rate helps keep inflation down. But prices have risen steadily for years, and so has frustration among Senegalese like Tcherno Alissi, who heads a construction and moving business.
Le franc CFA, c'est un franc de la colonie.
It's colonial money, he says. You can't use the CFA outside West and Central Africa. And for the French, it's just paper. They print as much of it as they like, then they unload it here in exchange for our raw materials.
En échange, ils prennent leur matière première.
At the Rosa Luxemburg Foundation in Dakar, Senegalese development economist Ndongo Sambasila explains that after World War II, Paris was determined to maintain a so-called sphere of influence in Francophone countries as colonialism began to wane.
The French told them, we are going to give you independence, but without sovereignty over any state domain. For example, public education, foreign trade, currency management, and so on. So that's why this system is colonial.
Sila says no genuine development has been feasible with France holding up to two-thirds of the foreign currency reserves of these former colonies. That's led to a constant reliance on imported commodities and hardly any job creation. As for the CFA, newly independent countries that tried to go their own way were punished. When Guinea introduced a separate currency, France flooded the nation with fake banknotes. In Togo, the country's first president, Silvanos Olympio, was assassinated in a coup d'état just 2 days before his planned launch of a new currency in 1963. Few in this part of the world think the timing was a coincidence. What followed was a succession of governments across the region that largely ignored the needs of their own populations.
Most of the leaders that you had from the 70s were considered the puppet of the West or puppet of France.
Gabriel Baglo, a Togolese journalist and consultant based in Senegal, was born 1 year after his country's independence. He recalls a childhood fraught with silent resignation about France's grip on Togo.
Even your father in front of you is afraid to say something because you don't know who will report you. It was just like what you have in the former USSR. So there are issues you cannot discuss.
So you never asked your parents, why are we speaking French at school and why do we have this money and why?
No, those are no good areas. They even teach you that you should be happy you are learning the language of the white man.
That was the message at school?
Yes. If you are speaking your mother tongue in class, you even punished. They can even beat you.
Democracy was the word of the day after the end of the Cold War, Baglo says. But with policies largely dictated from Paris, reforms in Francophone Africa didn't go very far.
So all those things have triggered a lot of frustration in the population, especially the young generation, who, with the benefit of digital development, they are aware of everything.
And they're organized. A movement called FRAP, the Front for an Anti-Imperialist Popular and Pan-African Revolution, has branches across Senegal and tens of thousands of followers online. It formed 5 years ago in a drive to stop big French companies from pushing out local businesses while expanding their own presence in the country. FRAP's slogan, France dégage, means France buzz off, as 24-year-old spokesman Gérard Koita explains.
Là où nous avions dit France dégage.
People thought this phrase was a bit harsh at first, he says. But what our forefathers endured under colonialism was far worse. France should simply get its hands off our monetary system. With the introduction of a new currency bogged down by the pandemic and other problems, young Senegalese are turning out in droves to support politicians who back the France Buzz Off campaign.
Nous pensons que ce sont les fils et filles de ces pays-là qui peuvent en tout cas faire émerger le pays.
We believe the sons and daughters of this nation should be the ones to take this country forward, Koita says. It's not up to France, the U.S., or anyone else to do that.
Voilà.
La jeunesse sénégalaise.
It's hard for some French people to understand this desire to shake off what locals call mainmise, the French word for stranglehold.
Pourquoi? Parce que je pense qu'il y a une forme d'incompréhension.
Catherine Vivian and her husband Daniel, retired from advertising, settled in the Senegalese capital nearly 50 years ago.
Ils sont assez intolérants.
They're disappointed by what they see as a lack of tolerance and historical understanding among Senegal's younger generation.
Les relations se sont un petit peu éloignées. Voilà.
We're drifting apart, Catherine says. She finds it sad that ties between France and Francophone Africa are weakening.
Par contre, elle a eu aussi des côtés positifs.
Danielle insists the past wasn't all bad and that Senegal wouldn't be where it is today if it hadn't been colonized.
Et puis avec des dogmes.
To economist Ndongo Sambasila, such views reflect France's relationship with its former colonies, which he calls paternalistic. These countries need partners, he says, not parents. But he stresses that Senegal's resolve has nothing to do with hostility toward the French people.
This is not anti-French sentiment. This is a positive desire for liberation. That's why we have to go beyond propaganda to try to find ways to address the challenges we have. Because in Africa, we have very big challenges. And to overcome those challenges, we need a democratic revolution. That's my feeling. That means a new way of organizing political life.
And that calls for homegrown solutions rather than policies dictated by France. This song is about the million or so Senegalese who have sought their fortunes abroad and returned to make something of their lives back home. Gone so many years, says singer Souleymane Faye, but all the experience in the world won't change the hardship here. Today's young generation is eager to turn that around. This is Alexa DeVorsen in Dakar.
Alexa DeVorsen is a Berlin-based journalist and correspondent. Read more about Senegalese opposition leader Ousmane Sonko at greenplanetmonitor.net. While you're there, subscribe or donate or both. With your generous help, we'll keep delivering stories about planet Earth, human development, justice, and science to listen to, read, and watch. For those who don't know a whole lot about global politics and international affairs, Canada is seen as a kinder, gentler, more enlightened country than its neighbor to the south, with a young, photogenic leader always talking about human rights, justice, and international law. Eve Engler sees things very differently. Engler is a Montreal-based writer and political activist. Japan, Japanese naval forces joining Turkey and Italy in naval training maneuvers in the Mediterranean as part of NATO. What the heck is Japan's naval forces doing training alongside Turkey and Italy in the Mediterranean with NATO? You have to ask, what is NATO all about?
Well, NATO, I mean, they just set up an office in Japan, right? The NATO statement there last summer, at the summit last summer, they put Russia as the top threat, and then they had China as the second threat. And I forget the exact language they used, but it was directed at China. NATO is a tool of U.S. military power around the world. But to me, this isn't new, right? NATO was founded. I've written about this a bunch, but NATO was founded. It's founded for two main reasons. One was actually domestic to Western Europe and to undermine the socialist and communist parties in Western Europe that were very powerful in Italy and France at the end of World War II. And to station North American troops in Europe to undermine that. But the other part was about bringing the former colonial world under the U.S. geopolitical umbrella. So after World War II, France and Britain and the other European colonial powers were weakened, and the decolonization process began. And so Canada provided all kinds of weaponry, gave all kinds of weaponry to the French while they were trying to maintain control over Vietnam, while they had 400,000 troops in Algeria. Canada was providing bullets to the French, giving, not selling, giving bullets to the NATO Mutual Assistance Program to suppress the independence movement in Algeria. Same for the British in fighting the so-called Mau Mau, the Kikuyu in Kenya and the Belgians while they were trying to maintain control over Congo. So NATO has always been, and if you look at Lester Pearson, he justified the Korean War in 1950, Canada sending troops. He justified that in part publicly here in the House of Commons on the creation of NATO. So we basically NATO became a tool to justify, you know, U.S., Canada dominating the whole world. And so now this is being more formalized in you know, NATO, you know, relationship with Japan. And clearly we're on the path where NATO is going to consider China this sort of major threat. And you know, probably South Korea is going to be, I think some South Korea officials are invited to the upcoming summit, or I forget the exact, there's deepening relation between NATO and South Korea, and of course, alongside Japan. So this goes to the whole, you know, this completely insane idea that the proponents of the NATO proxy war that they talk about is NATO's a defensive arrangement. NATO's defensive.
Within the sphere of the North Atlantic. It's a North Atlantic organization aimed at promoting, sustaining peace and security across the Atlantic.
Yeah, and it, you know, what was Afghanistan? It was a NATO mission, Libya. You know, so this is completely ahistorical. And it gets to understanding why the Russian government doesn't want, you know, NATO expansion anywhere to the east, but specifically wouldn't want Ukraine to be in NATO, considering the geographical location of Ukraine, the size of Ukraine, and how threatening to Russian security that is. NATO should be abolished. NATO should never have been created. And then at the end of the Warsaw Pact, so whatever justification was, you know, ostensibly given for NATO's creation, it ended, and NATO should have been abolished. Instead, what happened is NATO expanded, and it's expanding further.
Let's move considerably further to the west, to Venezuela. I was just on Global Affairs Canada's website, and according to Global Affairs Canada, Venezuela is, quote, one of the primary sources of geopolitical tension and instability in the Western Hemisphere. That's Venezuela, according to Global Affairs Canada. Can you comment on that?
I wonder what they say about the U.S. What if there is the U.S. one of the major forces of instability in the Western Hemisphere? Because I would say the U.S. is a far greater force for instance, but no, I mean, the Canadian government has been trying to overthrow the Venezuelan government for at least 6 years since we created the Lima Group back in mid 2017. Canada, Peru set that up to try to oust the Maduro government. It's been a failure. It's obviously been very devastating for Venezuelans. The sanctions that the Canada has had four rounds, but obviously primarily the U.S. sanctions have, and all the theft, you know, the British theft of Venezuelan government assets and stuff like the billions of dollars that are still being held to today. All that is has, you know, greatly weakened the Venezuelan economy, and that was obviously done after the price of oil dropped and Hugo Chavez died, and the country, you know, was already weakened. There was all kinds of downturn already, and then they just piled on with these different sanctions, and that began under Barack Obama, and then Trump deepened that. But yeah, the whole Juan Guaido charade there of deciding some marginal opposition politician should be president. It's obviously failed. Now Guaido is in Miami or somewhere in the States.
And it's interesting that apparently I was reading about this. I think it was in January that the United States switched its position that Juan Guaido was no longer the United States' choice for the legitimate leader of Venezuela. The U.S. shifted its position. And somebody asked, vis-a-vis Juan Guaido, and somebody asked Melanie Joly, the Canadian foreign minister, so what's Canada's position? The U.S. has just said Juan Guaido is no longer them. And Apparently, Melanie Joly didn't know how to answer it, so they consulted with their American counterparts, and just like that, Canada's position shifted. It no longer recognized Juan Guaido as Venezuela's official leader.
Yeah, no, Canada was the last country, I think, or right after the U.S. and maybe Britain, I'm not sure, who formally said, okay, this whole farce is done.
So, but Canada had to go and consult, apparently, it would seem, based on the reports that I read, that Canada had to first consult with the U.S. to find out what the U.S.'s position was, and then Canada took that same position.
Oh, I mean, there's no doubt that the Canadian policy on Venezuela has been deeply coordinated with Washington going back years and years. That's, I mean, they barely pretend to hide that. So, yes, that's been, Canada's been that way. And Canada, again, in the case of Venezuela, you know, funding opposition groups, sanctions, bringing Venezuela to the International Criminal Court. I mean, it's a joke.
And I don't want to be naive, but back when I was younger and Pierre Trudeau was prime minister, he was a friend of Fidel Castro's. He opposed the American blockade on Cuba. Canada maintained its relationship with Cuba when Pierre Trudeau was prime minister. And I, you know, you can correct me, but Pierre Trudeau was seen as kind of progressive towards the socialist-leaning countries of Latin America. Like, what's the story today? Why does Canada take such a troglodyte position on Venezuela and other Latin American and Central American countries?
Well, Pierre Trudeau worked very actively to destabilize Salvador Allende and overthrow and support Pinochet's coup in Chile. I mean, if you look at the record there, I mean, when Allende lost the 64 election, they increased aid quite explicitly because they wanted to marginalize Allende. And then when he won the 1970 election, they supported cutting off IMF funding, Export Development Canada ending funding, Canadian banks getting funding, efforts to have visits between the different countries. Diplomats were opposed by Pierre Trudeau's government on the grounds that they would provide some diplomatic legitimacy to Allende's government. And then when Allende was ousted, within 3 weeks, Canada recognizes Pinochet. And the Canadian ambassador, there's a famous cable where the Canadian ambassador refers to those being killed in the Santiago football stadium as the, quote, riffraff of the Latin American left. And that Pinochet is, quote, sobering Chile up, which was meant killing large numbers of people to, you know, get rid of the leftists. And then immediately we begin supporting IMF funding when there's this general in charge, no longer the elected president, Export Development Canada, Canadian weapons get sold pretty quickly. Canadian mining companies, re-enter. So Canada was implicated in the 1973 coup against Allende. So the idea that there's some history. I'm doing a book where it talks about 24 different coups Canada has supported, mostly supporting the U.S., primarily in Latin America. There's a long history of this. Justin Trudeau is following a long pattern of conservative liberal party backing of the ousting of elected and legitimate presidents around the world. Now, is it more extreme today than it was during than Pierre Trudeau? Was there a bit more room for maneuver? Was there a bit more independence from the U.S.? We've got to remember, Pierre Trudeau, when he came to office, one of the things he put on the table was Canada withdrawing from NATO. Well, that's completely outside of bounds. Even the NDP, even the Green Party doesn't raise that question. So there was an actual a discussion among foreign policy elite about Canada withdrawing from NATO. It prompted a huge howl of outrage from Lester Pearson, the ended prime minister, who that was the one thing that he re-engaged to ensure that we how dare you talk about withdrawing from NATO. So it didn't go anywhere, but it was the fact it was even put on the agenda, I think, spoke to the fact there was a moment in the late 1960s, in large part because of anti-Vietnam War protests, this sort of breaking down of Canada's deep ties to the U.S. Empire, and there was some room for some independence. And the Cuba question is one where, you know, of course, the famous visit in 1976. But the Cuba question even itself is a bit more complicated. If you look at the historic record, you'll find that the Americans didn't pressure Canada to break off relations with Cuba because, and this is from the internal government documents, they wanted the Canadian embassy in Havana to spy for the U.S., which the Canadian embassy did. For you know, decades, and provided, and there's all these quotes from top American officials, military officials, Canada provided the best intelligence for the Americans on Cuba. So also when it came to how Cuba dealt with Canadian companies were big players before Castro, right? Came banks dominated in Cuba, and that goes back to when the Americans invaded, because American banks couldn't operate internationally, so Canadian banks became their preferred operators, and the Canadian RBC becomes the biggest bank in Cuba because of the American invasion, American occupation. So this history around Cuba itself is a little bit more complicated, but certainly what Pierre Trudeau was doing on Cuba is and declaring a certain degree of independence from the U.S. is something that we do not see from Justin Trudeau today.
Eve, I there's a bunch of questions. I have a whole bunch of questions I want to ask. Let's try to zoom through these quickly. I was talking to Peter Larson of the Ottawa Forum on Israel-Palestine about Canadian foreign policy vis-a-vis Israel-Palestine, and I was asking him, like, why does Justin Trudeau take the position he takes and his government takes the position he takes vis-a-vis Israel that's been declared an apartheid state by all and sundry, and the Trudeau government says, oh, we don't use that word. And I asked Peter Larson, like, why do you think Trudeau takes this position in his foreign policy? And Larson said to me, Trudeau does not determine Canadian foreign policy. It's the Liberal Party that determines Canadian foreign policy. The Liberal Party is, of course, in power. Trudeau is a Liberal. So the Liberal Party, it's the Liberal Party that determines foreign policy. Can you comment on that?
Yeah, I wouldn't frame it like that. I think Justin Trudeau does determine foreign policy with regards to Israel, and Justin Trudeau is the Israel, the incredible pro-Israel policy is due to U.S. empire reasons, the lobbying by the Israel lobby in Canada reasons, the use of anti-Semitism allegations as a stick to scare pro-Palestinian forces. Canadian foreign policy is never based upon what's right. It's based upon power always, right? So it's not, they're not going to stand up for Palestinians just because it's right. I mean, that's not how the Canadian state functions. So it's a mix of a whole bunch of different kind of political forces that explain it. I don't think Justin Trudeau knows or really cares one way or another about Israel. I don't think this doesn't emanate from his personal beliefs in any way. There's that interview that Stephen Bronfman, who was Trudeau's biggest fundraiser, who was main fundraiser when he became head of the party, and Stephen Bronfman explicitly links his fundraising for Justin Trudeau to having brought Trudeau to Israel, and he actually says, oh, Harper hasn't even, this is back in 2013, you know, when Harper was prime minister, and he said Harper hasn't even been to Israel. So Trudeau, implying that Trudeau is a stronger supporter of Israel. But it's a whole bunch of different political factors, and I don't think the Liberal Party or Justin Trudeau as an individual are particularly important in understanding that.
Canada is seeking a seat on the Human Rights Council. The United Nations is a Human Rights Council for 2028 to 2030. It's a really long lead-up. Canada's going to have, 5 years to spruce up its bid for a seat on the Human Rights Council. Thoughts on this? Should Canada have a seat on the Human Rights Council? Canada, of course, proclaims itself as the staunchest of staunch defenders of human rights, international law, the rule of law, and most specifically human rights. And so it wants a seat on the Human Rights Council. What's your thoughts on this?
I mean, my thoughts is mostly that this is an opportunity to actually raise awareness about Canada's human rights violations, like we did with United Nations Security Council bid. Why that was that campaign, which you, of course, were part of, that was an opportunity to basically challenge a whole bunch of Canadian foreign policy issues that don't get much attention in the dominant media. And in that case, we were successful. Obviously, the Security Council is a bit higher profile than the Human Rights Council. I think that, you know, does Canada, can Canada